The headlines: U.S. House Speaker reiterates Washington's support for Taiwan while China condemns her visit to Taipei, saying those who play with fire could perish by it. Russia warns that it could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct involvement of NATO countries over the Ukraine conflict. And the leader of Hezbollah slams U.S.'s empty promises for supplying natural gas and electricity to Lebanon, saying nothing has happened after a year. Our top story for this half hour. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who's on a visit to Taiwan, says that her country won't abandon its commitment to the self-ruled island.
Today, our delegation, of which I'm very proud, came to Taiwan to make unequivocally clear we will not abandon our commitment to Taiwan, and we are proud of our enduring friendship.
Pelosi says the message of her trip is this: America's solidarity with Taiwan is crucial. She was speaking after talks with Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, said the island will not back down as China geared up for military drills in response to Pelosi's trip. Taiwan's defense ministry also called the drills an irrational move to challenge the international order. Beijing denounced Pelosi's visit immediately after she landed in Taipei on Tuesday evening.
The United States constantly distorts, obscures, and hollows out the One China principle. These moves, like playing with fire, are extremely dangerous. Those who play with fire will perish by it.
China has also vowed targeted military actions in response to Pelosi's visit. She's the highest-ranking American official to visit Taiwan in 25 years. Beijing considers the island as part of its territory and says it will one day join the motherland. China is strongly opposed to U.S. military and political support for Taiwan, saying it emboldens pro-independence forces there. In the wake of Pelosi's visit, China put curbs on fruit and fish imports from Taiwan while halting sand shipments to the island. Political analyst Qin Dozhu earlier joined us from Beijing. We talked to him about China's warning over Pelosi's visit and asked him why Beijing is so furious about the trip. Let's take a listen to his comments.
Well, I think, you know, the warning basically is that it's not only about Pelosi's visit alone here. Since Trump's time, actually, we see the U.S. has gradually been undoing this One China principle, which is a commitment from the U.S. side to China. This One China principle is also the political foundation of the normalization of relations between China and the United States. In 1979, U.S. President Jimmy Carter announced the establishment of diplomatic relations between U.S. and China. In that announcement, which was live on TV at that time, he made it very clear the U.S. will not develop official relationship with Taiwan anymore as part of this One China pledge. You know, you see, what we are seeing is the U.S. Growing betrayal of their commitment to China. And then that is obviously damaging the foundation of conducting normal relationship between the two countries. That's why the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said that, you know, the U.S. credibility is in crisis, has gone bankrupt. Obviously, with this visit, you know. So I think China's warning is that, you know, there's a danger, there's a serious danger. And do we need another, say, could it be like World War III? You know, people are talking about that. Another war in this region, another crisis in this region. Well, the world is filled with multiple crises right now. Again, it shows the irresponsibility of Washington, the irresponsibility of Pelosi, including the Biden administration.
Russia has accused NATO countries of what it calls a fierce hybrid confrontation against the country that Moscow says dangerously balances on the edge of open military clash. Russia says that it stands for preventing the clash, but it will not back down if the West tries to test Moscow's resolve. Those comments were made by senior Russian foreign ministry official At the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Conference, Alexander Trofimov also said the conflict in Ukraine does not warrant Russia's use of nuclear weapons. But he added that Moscow could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct aggression by NATO. In the meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry has accused the U.S. of direct involvement in the Ukraine war. The ministry has referred to comments by a Ukrainian official about the way Kiev had used Washington's HIMARS rocket system launchers based on real-time information. On this segment of the program, the leader of Hezbollah resistance movement has slammed U.S.'s empty promises for the transfer of natural gas and electricity from Egypt and Jordan to Lebanon. Said Hassan Nasrallah said 1 year has passed since the U.S. ambassador's promise, but nothing has happened in practice. He added that the movement had proposed to buy fuel from Iran to meet Lebanon's energy needs, but the U.S. did not allow that to happen. Nasrallah said the United States and Israel are the embodiment of the devil, and Hezbollah's struggle against them will continue. Nasrallah's remarks came 2 days after he issued a stern warning to Israel about exploiting Lebanon's offshore energy resources. Nasrallah said the resistance movement is ready for any scenario, including a war, to protect those resources. The dispute between Lebanon and Israel escalated in early June after the regime sent a drilling ship to the Karish gas field in the Mediterranean. Lebanon dismisses Israel's claim that the field falls within its so-called exclusive economic zone. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Mariam Saleh, who's joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, we have academic and political commentator Mr. Mohsen Saleh, who's also with us from Beirut. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mariam in Beirut. Walk us through the recent comments and the highlights of Lebanese resistance movement Secretary General of Hezbollah, Said Hassan Nasrallah.
Yes, well, this happened even last year, and usually in the Ashura speeches, Said Nasrallah is quite decisive when it comes to issues related to the politics of the country or even issues related to the standoff with Israel. And so what we're seeing right now is not just a standoff with Israel. We also have this sort of face-off with the U.S. itself, which has not proclaimed openly that it has enforced sanctions on Lebanon. However, what we are seeing are indirect sanctions that are being enforced. This started, of course, with the crisis, but this comes even before the crisis. The issue of the electricity in Lebanon, this crisis goes way back, and we have, in addition to the civil fighting that occurred in Lebanon, we also have the continuous Israeli aggressions and strikes on Lebanon's infrastructure, which has led to this crisis. And of course, what we're seeing right now is the worst crisis of all, where we don't have any fuel coming into Lebanon. There are weeks where people have absolutely no electricity. When there is fuel, people can witness maybe an hour or two of electricity. So this is what we're talking about, a really major crisis. And that was the case even more after the economic fallout here in Lebanon. At that time, Hezbollah had vowed that they would bring in diesel from Iran, and they did. And those were all donations to Lebanon. They were sold to some hospitals, but they were also donated to orphanages and so on. That solved the crisis for quite a while. However, after that promise by Hezbollah, after that implementation, we had also another promise from the U.S. ambassador. And up until now, we have not seen anything. We know that the Egyptians are ready to send the gas. We know the Jordanians are ready. The Syrians are ready. They've even made the maintenance necessary for their pipelines to bring in gas to Lebanon in order for Lebanon to witness more hours of electricity. However, up until now, we know from the Egyptians and the Jordanians that the U.S. has not given Lebanon the exception from the Caesar Act. And this is because our gas needs to go through Syria. So Sanders Hall is trying to show that the U.S. has only made empty promises so far, and nothing has been done in that regard. And he's mainly calling out on those who consider themselves friends of the U.S. or allies of the U.S. here in Lebanon, who continue to criticize any assistance that comes from the Islamic Republic of Iran and any assistance that's being done by Hezbollah, any endeavor that would assist in that regard. Hezbollah, of course, has attempted to try to lead the course of the talks in the maritime borders and so on and so forth. But still, you have sides that criticize. So therefore, Senator Saleh is showing them and trying to tell them that the U.S. has made us promises, but nothing has happened so far. While on the other hand, the Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to give fuel, maybe even in Lebanese lira, in many cases, in order to allow for Lebanon to come out of this unforeseen crisis.
All right, Mohsen Asala, also in Beirut, as we just read, the leader of Hezbollah resistance movement has slammed the U.S.'s empty promises for the transfer of natural gas and electricity to Lebanon. 1 year has passed since the U.S. made that promise. Why has the U.S. stalled in this process?
I guess Sayyid Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah and the Secretary General, wanted to make two kinds of the signals and admonitions to the Lebanese, and especially those who belong to the axis of America and the Israelis and the Saudis, and also to the Americans and to the Israelis and these Arabs. For the first team, most of these people, especially from the 14th of March, and even the president of the cabinet, Miqati, they are not moving towards ameliorating the situation of the Lebanese, especially concerning electricity and the oil issue and the diesel issue and the electricity and all these things that belongs to the lives of the Lebanese. So what he is saying to them, well, look, we have given a promise and we have fulfilled this promise and we brought diesel from Iran. And now we suggest to bring the fuel for the electricity in order to make the situation in Lebanon better. So the Americans promised you to do something 1 year ago, and they haven't done anything. And they haven't done, on the contrary, except or but the bad things to Lebanon, severe sanctions against Lebanon, severe relations with Lebanon, and they are trying to ruin the situation in Lebanon. And you are still, you the Lebanese, you are still putting or lying or promised by the Americans, and nothing has been done. So you are going to the deterioration of the situation in Lebanon. While we are giving solutions, you have to do something. You have to tell your friends, whether the Americans or the Saudis, to bring something to the Lebanese in order to have light, to have electricity, and you are not doing anything. And since we are, as a resistance, protecting Lebanon and liberated Lebanon from 2000, 2006, and the Americans still are pressuring Lebanon in order to surrender. He is saying to them, look, we are not gonna surrender. You have been relying on these people, and you are doing very harmful things to the Lebanese, and we are trying to do good things from the liberation of the lands in the south to the issue of the diesel and the things that belong to the welfare of the Lebanese. So that's the main issue that still Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon are trying their best in all kinds of relations with their friends, with their allies, to do good things. Even the Iraq fuel came through this situation, this channel. Not only, although Al-Kazimi and these people, they have kind of relationship, but still Hezbollah is grabbing the situation and trying to say, well, the Syrians accepted the situation. the suggestion of the Americans to bring the gas from Egypt through Jordan to Syria, the Syrians accepted that because the Hezbollah talked to the Syrians, and they want to do a favor for the Lebanese, except that the Israelis pressured the Americans and these Lebanese, the 14th of March, who belong to this line, trying to betray the Lebanese people, not only the resistance in Lebanon, betray the Lebanese by lying and promising things they won't do, just to say, well, look, we can do something. They are not doing anything, this Hezbollah and the resistance. And the time, the people in Lebanon, they believe, and they are really faithful to the promises of the resistance. And now, after year and year after year, the Lebanese now, they believe in the resistance more than they do in the others, especially the 14th of March. So that's why you see most of the Lebanese now, they really think, why this government does not really ask the Iranians and ask Hezbollah to bring the fuel from Iran.
All right, thanks a lot. Academic and political commentator Mohsen Saleh joining us from Beirut. And thanks to our very own Mariam Saleh also joining us from Beirut. Moving on, the U.S. Says that it is selling new missile defense systems to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates with more than $5 billion. The State Department says Saudi Arabia will buy 300 units of Patriot missile systems, which can be used to shoot down long-range ballistic missiles and aircraft. The Saudi order is worth over $3 billion, according to the department. New missiles will be used to defend Saudi Arabia against drone and missile attacks from Yemen. Separately, the UAE is buying $2.25 billion worth of THAAD missile systems. Both countries have been targets of retaliatory attacks by Yemeni forces. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Wahid Deshne Barile Beteshne Barile Beteshne Barile Beteshne. Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. Hussein, Hussein, Hussein. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you. I cry for you in pain.
in the limelight. In Britain's Conservative leadership contest, Liz Truss has pitched herself as the Education Prime Minister, with a plan that includes replacing failing academies with a new wave of free schools and improving maths and literacy standards. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Press Association, PA Media. The piece is titled, Liz Truss Pitches Herself as the Education Prime Minister. Please stay with us for more of the article by the Press Association, PA Media. Britain's Conservative leadership contest, Liz Truss has pitched herself as the Education Prime Minister, with a plan that includes replacing failing academies with a new wave of free schools and improving maths and literacy standards. The Tory leadership hopeful, whose endorsement by party heavyweights have added to the sense that she is pulling ahead of her rival Rishi Sunak in the race for number 10 Downing Street, unveiled a six-point strategy on Saturday to get Britain's education system back on track. That includes expanding existing academies which are high-performing, while replacing failing ones with free schools, newly set up academies. Academies are state-funded schools that are independent from local authorities. In an often-repeated line of her leadership campaign, Liz Truss said she saw firsthand how children were failed and let down by low expectations during her comprehensive state schooling in Leeds. The remarks have previously drawn criticism from political leaders in the city and former pupils and staff of her former school, Roundhay. Liz Truss, a former Minister for Education and Childcare, also pledged to drive up the quality of maths teaching and meet the target for 90% of primary children to reach the expected standard in literacy and numeracy. She would aim to give working parents access to childcare around the school day and extend the range of providers who accept government childcare entitlements. The Foreign Secretary also said she would follow through on government plans to change staff-to-child ratios for young children, bringing England into line with ratios in Scotland, proposals that the Labour Party has called pathetic. Liz Truss, who studied at Oxford University, promised to reform admissions procedures for Oxbridge and other top universities, so students who get top grades in their A-levels would be automatically invited to apply. Truss said, "My six-point plan will ensure our education system gets back on track by giving every child the tools that they need to succeed." Through a laser-like focus on improving maths and literacy standards, we will make a real difference to children's lives, and by giving families greater choice and flexibility when it comes to childcare, we will also save them money. Truss has previously said she would end the ban on new grammar schools, selective schools that critics say might stretch brighter pupils but increase inequality overall as the attainment of other children suffers. Rishi Sunak has also said he backs their return, but it is understood to mean the expansion of existing grammar schools. The Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, has also pledged to help millions of renters buy their first home by making it easier to prove they're ready to take on a mortgage, but said she plans to scrap national house-building targets. The front-runner in the Tory leadership contest vowed to break down barriers to support those keen to get on the housing ladder. A day after outcry over rival Rishi Sunak's plan to block new residential property being built on the Green Belt, which experts said would only exacerbate the housing crisis, Liz Truss risked sparking similar criticism by saying she wanted to abandon top-down Whitehall-imposed housing targets. Official statistics show that more than half of current renters could afford a mortgage, but only 6% are able to access a typical first-time buyer mortgage due to most lenders not taking an applicant's ability to pay a certain amount of rent as proof that they can afford to pay a higher mortgage. Liz Truss said to help Generation Rent, an upcoming review of the system would allow rent payments to be used as part of the affordability assessment for a mortgage. The government is committed to building 300,000 new homes by the mid-2020s. But Liz Truss wants to rip up the red tape that is holding back house building by binning the target. Councils will instead get to choose how many new homes their communities need to build, her team said. But a Truss administration would work with local communities to identify sites ripe for redevelopment and reduce planning restrictions, turbocharging commercial and residential development.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
Is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Some observers call it another headache for the U.S., referring to a controversial visit by the U.S. House of Speaker to Taiwan. The Chinese U.S. ambassador has warned the visit could go as far as undermining Beijing-Washington's relationship. China had already warned it won't sit idle by, and the U.S. would have to pay the price for the visit. Nancy Pelosi has been on an East Asian tour, and her plane just landed in Taipei. Ironically, the visit is not backed by the White House. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our panelists in this episode and get down to business. Director of Globalist Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, joining us from Detroit. Also with us is journalist and author Daniel Lazar. He's in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Great to see you, gentlemen. Let me start with Saeed Khan. Given stark warnings by China against this visit, the U.S. did go ahead with the plan, and as you know, Pelosi is visiting Taipei, and we hear that Chinese are flying and crossing the Taiwan astray. Now, what goal is the U.S. pursuing by way of such a visit?
I think there's two goals that are really at work here. One is for the international audience, for the United States to appear as though it is strong, that it is pushing back on what is now certainly the emerging dominant superpower in the world, China. And the other is really looking at it in a domestic context. After all, this is the midterm elections year. And by showing the Democrats and by extension, President Biden, although, as you said, this trip is not officially sanctioned by the White House, but it would be highly unlikely that Speaker Pelosi would go without some kind of coordination or acknowledgement. After all, she is in a plane that says United States of America. I mean, she was going in an official plane from the U.S. Air Force. So it indicates that there is some effort to burnish the Democratic Party when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to trying to move the needle even slightly in what is going to be a very contentious and a very tight election this November. Mm-hmm.
Now, Daniel, there's also a division among U.S. authorities about this visit. The White House does not favor it. And President Joe Biden has even said that the military believes, I'm quoting, the visit is not a good idea right now. So why did Pelosi decide to go to Taiwan? I mean, who's calling the shots as far as the U.S. foreign policy is concerned?
Yeah, I mean, I must disagree with your previous speaker. I think the image that's being projected is of one of gross incompetence and disarray. I mean, you have the Speaker of the House, an 82-year-old woman, essentially making foreign policy on her own, while the Biden administration sort of stands aside and sort of shrugs. And not only is she making foreign policy, but she is making foreign policy in an extraordinarily dangerous way. Now, I think that this is not going to enhance U.S. standing around the globe. I think quite the contrary. It'll grossly undermine it. It'll show that the American leadership is incompetent, unreliable, immature, flighty, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it'll do the U.S. no good. It'll do it much harm. And I expect that Biden will be paying more and more of a price as things go on. And we haven't even seen yet what the full Chinese retaliation looks like.
Said, as you may know, Washington claims that it is adhering to this so-called One China policy, but it still provides weaponry and military hardware to Taiwan. How come? I mean, is it justifiable?
Right. First of all, I don't disagree at all with Mr. Lazar. The question posed to me was, what do I think is behind it? But the reality as to what would be the results are, I think, incredibly irresponsible for why Pelosi is in Taiwan. Segueing into your question regarding American policy, it's rather strange, isn't it, that the U.S. State Department has on its own website acknowledgement that it does not have diplomatic relations with Taiwan, but it has what it calls a, quote, robust unofficial relationship. One that seems to then extend to selling Taiwan a tremendous amount of weaponry, to be a thorn in the side of China, to be arguably as provocative with China in its presence with Taiwan as the Soviet Union was with Cuba during the 1960s. The only difference, of course, is that nuclear weapons are not being stationed in Cuba. But we are certainly in China's neighborhood and doing so in a provocative way. And now at a time when China can actually go ahead and flex its muscles in a much more robust way. And we're seeing that this is happening right now. You stated that the South China Sea airspace was closed by China. And also the announcement of 4 days of military exercises in the area. Including the stationing of a whole lot of Chinese weaponry on the shores facing Taiwan. Any kind of live ammunition that is going to be used is going to be heard in Taiwan, and it's going to send, certainly send a message. This is just a bad idea all around.
Daniel, same question for you, because China is complaining all the time that the U.S. is ignoring and disrespecting this one-China policy, but the U.S. is, we are sticking to it. At the same time, they're selling weaponry to Taiwan.
Yes, the U.S. is in the habit of saying one thing and doing the opposite. I mean, it's escalating things in the South China Sea and Taiwan, yet it insists in the same breath that it's not really escalating at all. In the Ukraine, it expanded NATO, steadily farther eastward, but then insisted that that it was not threatening Russia at all. Russia had no cause to be alarmed. There was nothing to worry about at all. So the U.S. has a way of completely belying its own statements, and that's what's going on here. I mean, clearly, the one China policy is a difficult, artificial policy, which at some point was going to fall apart. And the U.S. has an unofficially robust relationship with Taiwan, so it's officially unofficial. But the point is, I mean, Biden clearly is chafing at the bit. He's moving to overthrow the one China policy, but he's afraid to say so. So as a result, his policies look more and more incoherent, and no one knows where they're going. And China is getting seriously alarmed. It feels that a military confrontation is inevitable, so it's gearing up.
Saeed, there are some analysts who argue that this is part of the U.S. strategy to keep Russia stuck in the Ukraine war, and Daniel just mentioned Ukraine, and also China busy with Taiwan. Do you share the same view?
I'm really not sure. I mean, after all, those are two different scenarios. Keeping Russia bogged down in Ukraine at the expense of the Ukraine is rather cynical, but it wouldn't be the first time that the United States operates its foreign policy in such cynicism. Regarding Taiwan, I agree with Daniel that here this idea of almost taking a page out of Sun Tzu's Art of War, that if your enemy is annoyed, go ahead and annoy him more. And it seems as though this is just, again, a provocation more than really moving the needle one way or the other. After all, I cannot recall any serious presidential candidate going back several decades who has even broached the idea of announcing that they would recognize Taiwan and its independence. So clearly there is a line in the sand that no one seems willing to go ahead and cross. But the idea then of keeping China in a state of alarm in its own backyard, certainly if any foreign power were to enter the United States' stated zone of influence, whether it's through the good neighbor policy or the former Monroe Doctrine, there would be alarmism over here. It doesn't behoove the United States to treat a very important and a very large power, both economically and militarily, in this way, because the chances of a slip-up are just simply too large.
Mm-hmm. And Daniel, how do you look at this? Has the U.S. adopted this, what is called as a dual containment policy, with China and Russia to try and exhaust the two powers, and keep them in quagmires overseas?
I think that's sort of expecting too much of the U.S. I mean, I think, first of all, the war in the Ukraine is not going at all well from a U.S. perspective. The Russian war machine is grinding on. There are signs of instability and disarray in Kiev. Indications that things are not going at all well for the Zelensky government, and the global economy is in real trouble. So the American military policy has backfired. The sanctions have backfired. So I'm not really sure the U.S. knows what to do. And in this case, in Taiwan, it just appears to me that Biden, through sheer incompetence and neglect, has allowed himself to be maneuvered into a very dangerous situation by hotheads in his own party. And that is, he's lost control, he's lost leadership, and that is a very bad position to allow yourself to fall into. So I don't see the U.S. pursuing any kind of consistent policy. I see it pursuing a consistently incompetent policy.
Mm-hmm. And Syed, is this all aimed at creating a world in which the U.S. Is the sole superpower so that it could dictate its policies to other countries?
I think even the United States now is not so deluded into thinking that it could bring back unipolarity and become the sole superpower that it was in the aftermath of the Cold War in the early 1990s. Although certainly we do see examples where it has made that attempt with the expansion, as Daniel said, of NATO further and further encroaching into Eastern Europe and then former Soviet republics throughout the area, including the Baltic states, and certainly a push toward including the Ukraine into that. But I think that it shows a certain kind of clumsy acknowledgement that the United States is no longer the sole superpower, and where it can, it will then create diversions, it will create distractions, and it'll create these kinds of provocations, whether to distract the superpowers or hopefully not, create then an escalation. Because we have to ask ourselves a question, who would benefit with this kind of escalation in both rhetoric and then, as we see with China, military mobilization? Certainly the U.S. defense industry, I'm sure, must be salivating at the very idea that they can then justify selling more weapons, not only to the U.S. and increase its already rather bloated defense budget, but also to sell weapons to many of the regional entities, including Taiwan, as well as Australia and Japan, those two countries being, with India, part of the so-called strategic quad. Whether those countries want to then accept the gambit of America's incompetence and what would be seen as aggression in the area remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, do you agree with Syed?
I do, actually, but I would just add that in order to sell weapons and enlist the support of the Quad, the U.S. has got to maintain a very tough posture. It has got to show that it is the boss, and that is what is so dangerous, because essentially China is determined to show the same. So you have two countries in an increasingly confrontational mode, and we don't know what the result will be, but there's every reason to fear that things could and will get out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of this confrontational mode, Syed, I was just trying to get to that. The U.S. policy and the strategy overseas, are they not pushing countries like China and also Russia to try and to have to actually adopt this confrontational mode vis-a-vis the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it depends on, again, whether they're going to go ahead and accept what the United States puts on the table and then try to escalate it. Right now, we see that the United States was trying to isolate Russia into just one arena, which was the Ukraine. Unfortunately, here in the United States, there has been an almost steady drumbeat of trying to bring in the Taiwan situation and equate it with the Ukraine. Those two things had nothing in common. The status quo regarding China and Taiwan had been there for 50 years. It had not been an invasion. The United States itself acknowledges the sovereignty the lack of independence and sovereignty of Taiwan with the One China policy. And yet, as Daniel aptly said, there are people who are agents provocateurs within the Democratic Party. Certainly the Republican Party is always up for a good war. To then try to go ahead and rope China in. And I would say that it also then shows the weakness that the United States has of trying to leverage any kind of economic activity to weaken China. So right now we're dealing with some dangerous rhetoric and the possibility of a further military contextualization of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, U.S. policies do not seem to have been able to weaken other powers like China and Russia, don't they? The two are just getting closer to each other every day. They're even forming alliances with other nations, you know, pitching in. So what repercussions could it entail for the U.S.?
Well, I think the problem is the U.S. power is rapidly fading. And it's fading in a variety of ways. I mean, still its military clout is still considerable. Its economic clout is immense. There's no doubt about that. I don't want to exaggerate. But the U.S. simply doesn't have the profile it had during the golden age of 1991 to 2003. And Joe Biden came into office declaring America is back, and he's been trying to restore some of that lost glory. But I think in so doing, he's pushing things too far. And he is essentially getting into serious trouble in the Ukraine and now apparently in the Western Pacific. So I don't know where this is going to lead, but I see great instability in Washington. I see a Biden administration that really doesn't know what it's doing. I see a president who is extremely old and is personally not in control. And I see a Democratic Party which is gripped with panic as to what will happen in the upcoming midterm elections.
Now, Saeed, regarding this Pelosi visit to Taiwan, Russia has come out and announced that the way China has reacted to this is absolutely justifiable, and it's also given its full support to Beijing. So how significant could this be?
I think what this shows and it affirms is the relationship that Moscow and Beijing now have. If anything, they feel emboldened to be the so-called anti-heroes compared to the West. At the same time, I think it's also important to recognize that it doesn't seem as though too much of the West is really speaking out about this right now as far as endorsing what Speaker Pelosi is doing. There doesn't seem to be an awful lot of official statements coming out of Western capitals to demonstrate that they are in support of what the United States posture is, because they, of course, have very close ties with China, and they have to prioritize those, whether they're economic or for those countries in the Western Pacific, recognizing their own security needs and what might be seen as a rather mercurial relationship that the United States has. After all, when it comes to being able to depend upon or rely upon American consistency of policy, that is something that's been rather elusive over the last at least 20 years in many different arenas around the world, and people have been paying attention to that. On top of that, I think that the kinds of decision-making when it comes to American security interests have been woefully irresponsible. The Quad, for example, has three countries, one of which is effectively unable to really push back because of its proximity to China. I'm speaking of Japan. Australia just simply likes to go along for the ride with the United States. But you also have India, and India has proven to be militarily, strategically very weak when it comes to confronting China, as we saw last year with two border clashes, relatively minor, but ones that were certainly defeats for the Indian Army. But India also, it seems, despite the kind of warming of relations and the wooing by the Biden administration and other Western countries as well, has gravitated toward both Russia and, interestingly and ironically enough, even to China when it comes to addressing energy needs and breaching the sanctions that have been placed against both Russia and China. Right. So if that's really the case about America trying to project its power, it probably needs to use a different playbook.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, you know about warnings that China has been giving since maybe a week or so before this Pelosi visit to Taiwan. It said that U.S. is playing with fire. It warned against it and said that they should pay the price for this. And they announced, those targeted operations, some military exercises. Could it go further beyond this? Could it translate into a full-fledged war?
I think there really is no reason to think otherwise. I mean, what we've seen is a steady and now intensifying escalation. So it seems to be heading in only one direction, and that is towards some kind of confrontation. I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was possible a few years ago, but now it seems to be unavoidable. And for the U.S., the dilemma is that a war in China's backyard is one it really can't possibly win. The New York Times, for example, pointed out not long ago that the U.S. has two air bases within 500 miles of Taipei. China has 39. that's a woeful imbalance. And the Pentagon has staged 18 war games designed to simulate a China-U.S. showdown in the Western Pacific. And in every single one of them, the U.S. has lost. So the U.S. is facing real problems.
Okay. And Saeed, let's have your opinion on the possibility of war.
I think that, as Daniel said, it's more relative speaking that the chances are, unfortunately, greater now than they were earlier in the last few years. My concern is actually a war beginning out of a some kind of a reckless move, some kind of an accident, for example, one ship hitting another ship in the South China Sea could then be the provocation that lights the tinderbox. It would be nice to see cooler heads prevail, but it seems that right now, if one takes a look at the rhetoric, both coming out of Beijing as well as out of Washington, there seems to be a kind of amping up, almost an appetite for the prospect of war, hopefully not the inevitability of one.
And to Daniel, one last question, because Pelosi said that this shows our commitment, my visit shows our commitment to Taiwan. Is it really what the U.S. is trying to do, or trying to weaken China's influence, or what?
As I said, the America's actions are really inexplicable. The very fact that Pelosi is saying one thing and Biden saying another is very strange and very off-putting. The world doesn't like it. So it's not clear what the U.S. is doing. The U.S., but it is behaving more aggressively. There is a big reservoir of support for Taiwan in Washington. It seems as if the U.S. is gravitating towards some kind of repudiation of the one China policy. But if that happens, if that's correct, and if that happens, it'll be, the results will be titanic.
Okay, thank you so much for your contribution. Saeed Khan in Detroit and Daniel Lazar in New York. And thank you. I'll see you next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards independence and self-determination. The one who addresses Allah the Exalted on the day of Ashura, saying, "In so many difficulties and sorrows, matters which the heart cannot deal with, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances before you, O Allah, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his dialogues. Imam al-Husayn's response to Abu Hiram. O Aba Hiram, indeed the Umayyads belittled my reputation, but I endured. They confiscated my property, but I endured. And they wanted to shed my blood, so I felt insecure and departed. By Allah, they shall slay me, and Allah shall make them completely deprived with a sharp sword over them. He shall make a person suppress them, the one who shall denigrate them so that they shall be lower than the people of Saba when their queen was a lady who was controlling their properties and their lives.
As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifina'i alayka.
Dear audience, now let's listen to some parts of Ziyara An-Nahiya Al-Muqaddasa. Stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. As-salamu ala al-Husayn alladhi samihat nafsuhu bimuhjatih.
Peace be upon al-Husayn, who sacrificed himself up to the last drops of the blood of his heart.
As-salamu ala man ata'a Allah fi sirrihi wa alaniyatihi.
Peace be upon him who obeyed Allah secretly and openly.
As-salamu ala man ja'ala Allah shifa'a fi turbatihi.
Peace be upon whom Allah placed a cure in the soul of his place of martyrdom.
As-salamu ala man al-ijabatu tahta qubbatih.
Peace be upon the one under whose dome answer to supplications is guaranteed.
As-salamu ala man al-a'immatu min dhurriyatih.
Peace be upon the one in whose descendants are the imams after him.
As-salamu ala ibn khatim al-anbiya. As-salamu ala ibn sayyid al-aghsiyaya.
Peace be upon the son of the seal of the prophets. Peace be upon the son of the chief of the executors.
As-salamu ala ibn Fatimah al-Zahra. As-salamu ala ibn Khadijah al-Kubra.
Peace be upon the son of Fatima, the radiant. Peace be upon the son of Khadija, the great.
السلام على ابن سدرة المنتهى السلام على ابن جنة المأوى السلام على ابن زمزم والصفا.
Peace be upon the son of the low tree in the outermost boundary of heaven. Peace be upon the son of the garden of refuge. Peace be upon the son of Zamzam and As-Safa.
السلام على المرمل بالدماء السلام على المهتوك الخباء السلام على خامس أصحاب أهل الكسايا.
Peace be upon him who was saturated in his blood. Peace be upon him whose tents were violated. Peace be upon the fifth of the people of the cloak.
Oh.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبين